Welcome back to Behind the Biology. I'm your host, Dave Yarmusch, and this is part two of our three-part series with John Bagnoli. I always recommend listening to the first of the series if you haven't already, but just in case, John is the senior manager of the bioinformatics portion of the Sequencing and Bioinformatics Center at ATCC. He bridges the gap between R&D and the overall genomics needs of the company. Last week, we spoke about his early days in the industry of science, and today we're going to discuss how that transitioned into management and where the 2014 Ebola outbreak fits in. I know you had a particularly significant event at MRI Global. You were engaged in the Ebola response team.
That's right.
I could ask you some pointed questions about that. I've heard some of the stories, but I don't want to bury the lead. So first thing, you were either a robotics expert or a bioinformatician at that point. But from what I understand, you were doing a lot of sample processing.
Right. Well, that's what the robotics was for, sample processing.
Gotcha. So yeah. You were headed over there, making sure the machines were working all correctly and they could do their job. And then I would assume also helping out, you had biological training.
Yeah. No, at that point, I would say that was when I was the bioinformatician, right? However, that other experience came in handy. And there was a short time where I worked with the international group. If you remember, they had that office in Frederick, Maryland. So when the time came, they needed someone to be in charge, right? So we were sent out in teams so that no particular person was out there too long, you know, for stress. And because again, you're working with Ebola, you're working with infectious samples, you're working with human blood. So
not to mention that you're in Western Africa.
You've
probably never been to before.
Right. You're in a foreign setting, maybe out of your comfort zone a little bit. So you don't want to stress people out too much and have them make a mistake. So teams were rotated in and out. And just because, and so every team needed someone who was going to be basically the team leader. And management skills, the robotics, because we were doing robotic extractions on the blood for the PCR, someone with that kind of experience. So I just kind of fit the bill. And they were asking for volunteers. So I was like one of the first to put my hands up. I'm like, I can do this. You know, this is going to be great. This is fascinating. I want to go, you know. So the idea is that these were mobile laboratories. So if we rewind the clock a little bit, we got the contract to go out there. And the idea was that MRI Global had developed these mobile laboratories, which were shipping containers with laboratories installed inside them.
This is something MRI Global was known for at the time.
Yes, they had done this before on a more limited scale, but the government knew that they had these containers. So we sent out these containers and we would attach ourselves to the Ebola treatment centers, and we would do direct PCR of their blood to detect Ebola, right? Because what was going on at the time, anyone who had symptoms was brought to the treatment center. And the reason this is important is before the PCR was there, they would do blood culturing, and that took a long time. So if you didn't have Ebola when you went in and you were there for a couple of days, you got Ebola from the other patients who might have actually had it or did actually have it. PCR can get done in a few hours, right? So that was the whole point of doing that. So these things were then sent out. The idea is that they're mobile so that when we're done, you clean them off, you pick them up, you bring them to the next outbreak. But in the end, it was decided that the equipment would be better off serving the countries of West Africa and just basically leaving them there. So we had a training and transition mission where it was obviously training people to use all the equipment, which some of it they hadn't seen before, and then transition in terms of the government still has to figure out a way to pay for them. So it was petitioning the health organizations, the other NGOs, you know, the CDC was there, like, where are we going to get the money to keep these operational, right? So that was the other part of the mission as well.
So you described these mobile laboratories as basically shipping containers. And what I've got in mind is like a, you know, 10 by 20 big aluminum or steel box. How does that translate into a, you know, something the equivalent of a biosafety 4 laboratory to manage Ebola? You've got to have airflow. You've got to have hot and cold spots. It's got to be, not insulated, but like airtight in places.
Yep. Engineering, because they are exactly how you describe. They are, 10 by 20 aluminum boxes. Now, there's some good things about that. The reason why they're designed that way is it makes it easier to ship. because they're conforming to already established shipping protocols or whatever. Like, I don't know anything about shipping, but like it fits on a boat or on a plane that already exists and has been designed to carry these containers around, right? So what was interesting is basically there were a lab in a box. So we would jam everything in there. And the first thing you would do is unpack it all. So all the supplies were actually, it was filled as the shipping container should be. But in the meantime, the engineers had bolted in some biosafety cabinets. They had created the holes for the airflow system, which would be packed inside and had to be pulled out and then actually attached and tested and used, right? There were power requirements, because one of the interesting things is, you know, Africa runs on different type power. So we actually had to send generators that generated US type power and worked on US type sockets, which, as you can imagine, was kind of a pain when we had to transition to them. But that's, you know, just part of the problem. Because again, the idea was that they didn't stick around. You picked them up when you were done. So, you know, doing science in a box was very hard, because you could maybe get three people in there, but we would have to squeeze in four. You had partners and stuff as well. And we had the translator. So, you know, it was high. Well, that was the training. So when we were doing the actual outbreak, you know, there would be two of us in there at any time. You had to stick to protocol to protect yourself entirely. You know, you had to suit up. You had your partner check. You checked your partner. You know, you went in. Everything was, you know, things were passed in and out of, I forget what they call it now. You know, like there's a door on one side. If there's a sealed door on one side, put it in there. Sealed door on the inside. You open it up. You decontaminate, you know, that kind of thing. Obviously, there wasn't a lot of space, so you had to be, you know, in pretty good mental shape when you were, because you're pipetting and you're working with blood. You don't want to have any spills. And you just had to sort of adapt to that situation where you were way more concerned about optimizing your space than you ever would be in a laboratory. Even I'm sure academics, you know, who might listen to this, oh, I work in a small laboratory. Yeah, it's nothing like working in a container. Where you can't, like, you got your little respiratory pack on your back, you know, and you're leaning forward in the chair, and then you stand up and it gets caught on something because you only have like an inch of clearance between you and with the pack on the cabinet behind you, you know?
Right, because you're in full head to toe PAPR.
Full PAPR, yep, yeah. The whole nine yards.
So that exact kind of you know, how it's portrayed in media whenever there's like a radioactive outbreak or something, and you see the people in the helmets and the suits all white or orange or something.
Yeah. So we use the white ones, right? Because everything had to be disposable. So it was all disposable stuff. And afterwards you go out, you would, you know, you just get sprayed with bleach, and then you spray your partner with, oh my God, I don't use any bleach in my house. I can't, you know, they had 10% bleach solution, which you would wash your hands with and wash your feet with. It was like, oh my God, I can't smell bleach anymore. I can't do it. It's just, pulses me.
Like me, who's huffing bleach all the time.
All you bleach lovers out there, I apologize. It was, you're constantly working against the elements, because, you know, you do have a small box, and yes, there are sealed doors and everything, but the moment you open them, the environment's right there, you know, and sand comes in, insects, you gotta, you know, check for all that. You've got to do all your pre-check work. You've got to clean all your stuff before and after, you know, you're constantly doing those deep cleans where you're taking apart all the various equipment, the BSCs or whatever. And that was very hard on the equipment. You know, bleach is not, no matter how good you are with, you know, washing it down afterwards, bleach just corrodes everything eventually.
That's what it's for.
Yes, right? Exactly.
So I want to ask actually a little bit more about that process, because, you know, the day in, day out of a biologist is you go to the lab, you do your thing, maybe you put on certain equipment, maybe take it off. But all in all, it's routine and not that out of the ordinary. Between the full PAPR gear, which is a lot, you know, it's not like just a simple beekeeper suit, not to even say that's nothing, but, you know, it's a lot. It's hefty. It's significant. And then you've got no space. You've got four people crammed together. It's Western Africa. What time of year?
Oh, it was the dry season.
Yeah.
I was there at the end at the wet season, which was another thing that was just unbelievable to me. Mm-hmm. The amount of rain.
So considering the danger, right? Ebola is, you know, your go-to boogeyman of infectious diseases.
Yeah.
Horrible illness. And between that, you need to scrub everything down, scrub yourself down before you go in to avoid contamination, after you come out to avoid risk of illness. What does the day look like? How much time goes into simply maintaining the scientist and the box versus doing the job?
Most of it, right? Because again, we were still using the little robots that would fit inside the hoods to actually do the extraction process after we sort of did the manual part. But even then, while that was going on, you were then cleaning everything else. Well, I don't know, 80% of your time was spent cleaning, maybe, right? Mm-hmm. 20% actually doing science. And then you would have to transfer everything to the PCR lab, which is a separate box. So every major, for contamination purposes, every major step in the PCR process was a different laboratory. Like one for receiving, there was an office. There was the prep work, then there was the extraction, and the actual PCR lab at the end. There was another container that was for prepping PCR reagents because you can't let them be contaminated. So they had a whole they took one of the containers and divided it in half. They put a wall in. So one side was where you prepped all the reagents. The other side was where you actually did the PCR. And they weren't connected, right? You had to walk all the way out and go the other side if you wanted to go to that lab. But yeah, no, it was a lot. And remember, this was attached to the treatment center. So patients would come in. So you would get some samples, you know, you weren't sure what was going to happen next. You would then take off all your stuff. And then you're sweating just crazy because they did have some air conditioning, but you are talking 105 in the shade, you know, and you got all the things on. And you're just sitting at so we set up a little table on the outside and again, big thanks to the engineers, a little tent where we could go and sit down, sip some water. And then sometimes you'd be done. And then you would see those nurses coming towards you to be like, oh no, I just got out. 5 minutes later, you're doing it all over again. You're doing the whole cleaning process and everything. At worst, I think it would happen 3 times a day where you have to go in, you know?
And so how much does it take just to go in, like time-wise, is that 5 minutes to get all this gear on?
Oh, yeah. No, it's probably a good 20 minutes because, again, you want to be very careful. You have to check each other. So it's probably 20 minutes to don, maybe, you know, 20 minutes to doff, right, and clean yourself off and make sure that's all taken care of. So there was a lot going in there. But then it's like, you know, you're in there for 4 hours to actually do the whole process. And 3 of them you're cleaning, you know.
Yeah, so the cleaning, I think, is interesting because it sounds, I would imagine to anyone who's not familiar with this, it sounds excessive. You know, it's nonstop cleaning because the worst case scenario is you have a false positive result, right? You've got some contamination, the result is a false positive. And in most circumstances, that's the error you want, right? You want the false positive. You're going to have a false anything. You want the false positive, so that means you're providing a treatment that may not be necessary.
I guess but that is shit. Yeah.
In this case, a false positive means putting a healthy person into a quarantine.
Yes.
And then it becomes a true positive.
Yeah, exactly. We were saying earlier, you know, just the fact that they're waiting inside in some bed, they do their best, but both highly infectious, right? So what do you do? But yeah, that's why you do it. That's why you have to do all that cleaning, and you want to make sure you're getting good results, right? PCR was pretty difficult because, you know, PCR can go awry fairly easily with contamination.
Right, PCR will find anything.
Right, and we were using human genes, 18S genes, as a control, right? Because we got to make sure, okay, the sample is a person. You know, you sweat, you sneeze, you know, if you're doffed, you know, if you make one mistake, you touch your face before you go in, or you touch something else with your glove, or you're just like being lazy, that's it. And then it's ruined, you know, mm-hmm. And that's someone's blood. It's not like you can go in. I mean, there's always a little bit left, but then they're like, oh, we messed it up. You guys got to go back in and re-extract. Like, oh, go. So you have to be very careful. And the disappointing thing for me was that I understand, I'm no ill will, but you know, they didn't really want to use the results for anything but testing. And as we kind of talked about earlier, like that data mining, that's what I wanted. I'm like, where, you know, we got all this information about people. What can we find out about the progress of the disease and how it spreads and what you can do to prevent it? But, you know, for privacy reasons, the governments were like, you can't use any of this thing for anything. As a matter of fact, I think, I can't remember the university, but a university was basically like sequestering the data because there was a bunch of organizations doing this stuff, right? They got caught and they were just kicked out of the country. Like, nope, you know, you violated what we said, get out. And so, you know, you had to be very cognizant of that as well. You know, that data was protected, transferred a certain way, you know, and I didn't even mention this. Sometimes the samples would come remote. So we were attached to Ebola treatment centers, but some people would get sick too far away to come to the treatment center. So what they would do is whatever local clinic or hospital was around, they would take samples. They would put them in, you know, a container. They would go on the back of a motorcycle and somebody would just book it to the lab, right? And as you could imagine, people who aren't familiar with the proper protocols or aren't as good with sterile techniques, you'd open up these containers and it would be like, what am I looking at? You know, there are some, it's just, you did the best. Some of them you have to just get rid of it. Like, we can't do anything. It's broken. You know, some of them you'd get, it would be like, I don't know what's in this. It doesn't look like blood. I don't know what happened here, you know?
Walking back a bit, John, you were deployed to Sierra Leone because you knew the systems, you knew the protocols, and you were an established leader. About how long had you been in management by that point?
Oof, well, you know, I actually had my first management position way back in early 2000.
Right, that was when you were at that...
the startup company.
Right, in California.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I've had... That was 15 years of management at that point.
Okay, yeah. So... I'm sure it looked different at every site, but following, you know, the Ebola outbreak, how much do you feel like that changed the way that you managed, or at least your approach to it, your philosophy of it?
Well, it definitely gave me, because I was a robotics guy, I worked in the lab, right? And then I came back out and it was like, okay, I never want to pick up a pipette ever again in my life. And I went out there and had to pick up my pipette again and work in the lab and work with other people in very close quarters. You know, it gave me a bigger appreciation for logistics, right? Like, it was something that in other companies I kind of took for granted because there are people who took care of logistics for me, and having to talk to everyone, get everything in place, get materials and things to in a situation where you can't just go online and order something if you forgot. Like, you really had to plan and be very careful about it. And that's probably the biggest change where I really start to understand what it really meant to have a laboratory function smoothly when you're in a restricted environment. You know, you don't really appreciate that here in the United States and other places, probably because it's so easy to correct for errors. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so easy out there.
So if we were to fast forward to your current position, Senior Manager of Bioinformatics at the Sequencing and Bioinformatics Center of ATCC, how does that feel different? You've got a comparably small team. You know, there's what, five of us?
Yep.
To the team, and a larger group, and we've all got varying degrees of experience. So how does that balance work? And is that something that you've like consistently dealt with, or is that usually more of like a status quo? Everyone can at least do X, Y, and Z.
Well, that's actually a good question, because how you organize your team internally is something that is not a science, even though we're scientists, right? Everyone has their own personality. I think I mentioned before that one of the things I had to learn about management was to adapt my management style to the person that I was dealing with. And if you have five different people, you're probably going to have five slightly different ways to talk to people, right? You don't want to be, you're not being disingenuous, but you got to be mindful of how people like to be talked to and that kind of thing.
Right. Know your audience.
Right. And so that also translates a little bit into positions, because not everyone is equal. Obviously, you, for instance, are far more experienced than other members of the team. So how do we set up a team in such a way that it can accommodate that kind of balance? It's really about responsibilities, trying to lay out what a team has to do and who really is in the position to do it. But at the same time, you know, and we do this when we have our internal meetings, it's like, okay, who wants to be in charge of this particular thing, right? You know, do you want to do the RNA-seq stuff? Do you want to do, you know, the microbiome stuff, right? Like try to get a sense of interest. And that's really where you're trying to do the adaption, because not everyone's going to, especially because we're a small team, we have to, and we do so many different things at the SPC. We're asked to do so much different type of analysis. Everyone's different. You know, you have, and that's the real problem with, well, challenge, sorry, with managing people, in the sense that you want someone who's an expert in a particular field to work on it so that you can do good work, but you also don't want them to get bored and be like, oh, well, okay, I'm going to do nothing but RNA-seq. Why am I a scientist, right?
That's also in so many ways a challenge with bioinformatics, right? Because it could mean so many different things in different contexts, and different people. You could be a bioinformatics specialist your entire career and never get away from, you know, microbial genomics.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, it's also managing those expectations when you hire someone. You're like, look, this is what we're doing. You have to be on board with this. These are the things that we think we can do, and we can try to accommodate what you want to do in your career in the future. But this is what we're, this is the limitations. You have to understand those limitations. So you, as a manager, have to be honest and understand those limitations so you can communicate that directly. And that's, you know, and that's with the, and then, you know, going back to logistics, and when we went to Africa, you know, teaming up with the lab side of things is also part of that equation. Mm-hmm. We need people who can communicate directly with the lab team. We want everyone to feel like, even though we're in separate halves, everyone's still on that same team. They got to feel comfortable to communicate. People've got to know sort of the rank order. You know, there's always a hierarchy, even if there isn't a hierarchy. But we do, you know, again, you're a senior, so we give those types of positions to people like you. So you have that other level of authority, so you can get things done as well, right?
John Bagnoli leads the bioinformatics team within the Sequencing and Bioinformatics Center at ATCC. As someone who reports to him, I can say that his management style is definitely impacted by his varied career and experiences overseas during intense conditions, and that his philosophy on management is pretty effective. Check out our show notes for some more details on our conversation and some pictures from his time in Sierra Leone at atcc.org/behindthebiology. We have one more episode with John coming in the next week, so look out for that on your favorite podcast app. We'll be getting more into how he found himself in this field and what it really means.
I've been your host, Dave Yarmush from ATCC, where credible leads to incredible.